Welcome to Shoot Like a Girl, a podcast featuring interviews with extraordinary military women from around the world who push their limits on and off duty. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and this is episode number 15. Today's guest is First Lieutenant Riley Compton of the United States Marine Corps. Riley attended George Washington University on a softball scholarship before joining the United States Marine Corps as a logistics officer. After being inspired by Alana Myers Taylor, a Team USA bobsled member who also played softball at George Washington, she decided to submit her combine scores in hopes of becoming a bobsled athlete. She's now on the development team for USA bobsled with goals of competing at the 2026 Winter Olympics.
Steady, nice and steady. Light, hill, cover.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
So you better get out of my way now.
So you better get out of my way now.
Or I roll all over you.
Before I roll all over you.
All right, Riley, thank you so much for being here today. I'm super excited to talk to you.
I'm super excited. Thanks for having me.
So I always ask my guests where they're from.
So I was born in San Diego, California, but I grew up in Carmel, Indiana. So I moved to Indiana when I was about two. So I'm pure Midwest.
And what was your childhood like? Did you have any military members in your family or did you play any sports?
Yeah, so my dad was a professional baseball player. He played AAA baseball. So I started playing softball as soon as I could walk, basically. So I played softball my whole life and basketball, like being in Indiana, the Hoosiers, that's such a big thing. I played a little bit of volleyball, but the main two sports that I loved was softball and basketball. And then my mom, she was kind of active in sports. So she's very athletic. She never really took that with her career. She concentrated more academics. So she went to grad school and really well there. So I think I'm a nice blend of my parents. So I've had to prioritize my academics as well as athletics. But from a military standpoint, no one in my direct family really was in the military. However, my dad used to watch the Navy SEAL Bud videos. I don't know if you ever saw those.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah. So when I was little, when that series came out, I was allowed to stay up late at night if I watched that with my dad without my mom knowing, of course. So that was my first introduction to the military and at least, you know, going straight to the Navy SEALs, like seeing buds and what that lifestyle was looking like. So that seed was planted early without me really realizing it.
Mm-hmm. And then at that point, like, did you ever consider that as a career choice or did you have anything else, something else that you thought about like, oh, I want to do this when I grow up?
Yeah, no, that was not something I thought about at the time. And especially because when you looked at it, it was just male dominant. So I didn't see any females. I didn't think that that was really ever an option. So I accepted a scholarship my sophomore year of high school to go to George Washington University in DC. So that definitely played a consideration into going to DC because I wanted to work for a three-letter agency like the FBI, CIA, DOD, you know, for the military, but not in the military. Because like I said, I just didn't really see that there was a lot of females or that presence or anything like that.
And then, so how did you become aware of that originally?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So I get on the campus, I'm 18 years old. It's like within 2 weeks of me stepping into DC. Like I said, I'm from Indiana, far from home. And I was wearing my George Washington softball gear and I met a Marine recruiter and he was a captain and spoke really well, you know, super fit, like all the above, like met the eye test. And we just had some conversation and he kind of piqued my interest. And then next thing I know, I kept having meetings with him. The next thing I know, I started running PFTs and CFTs and going to these events. And before I knew it, I was hooked as an 18-year-old going to OCS.
Did they then pay for, or I guess you were already on a scholarship, but did you, I guess, enroll or enlist at that point for the rest of your college career?
Yeah, I did not. Softball, I'm very loyal in what I was there. Softball was paying for school. Mm-hmm. And that was my focus at the time, you know, was playing softball and being a Marine was my shift and focus in the summers. I was still definitely doing double workouts, but in a softball season, we play 60 plus games a year and we play double headers. We play up to 7 games a week. So there wasn't a huge focus. But no, what I did was I ended up going to OCS. So I got paid when I was at OCS. And then because I had a 3.8 GPA, I got an incentive pay. So it was like $1,500 a semester. But if I didn't join the Marine Corps, I had to pay it all back. So that was another hook that they got in me. Because I got to start that after my freshman year after completing OCS. So they went that way. So I didn't do ROTC. I didn't really commit to anything other than my summers to OCS. And then I would just do additional workouts in the day to get after it.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like insanely busy with that softball schedule and then doing school on top of that. So OCS, can you explain that? Because I'm Canadian and I'm not overly familiar with the process in the US.
Yeah. So OCS stands for Officer Candidate School. This is kind of the pipeline for people who want to become officers. They have to go through Officer Candidate School. No matter who you are, to be an officer, you have to go through this course. It's in Quantico, Virginia, and there's a couple different routes. So there's really two routes. One's called PLC and one's OCC. So PLC is Platoon Leaders Course, and that's when you have not graduated college yet. So you get an option of doing net. Then within PLC, you have two options. You can do 2 6-week courses or 1 10-week. So because I was so young, I went after my freshman year, I was able to do the 2 6-weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's very common for people. No one that did ROTC, people who sparked their interest really early on. And then the second 6 weeks is everyone who did ROTC and the people who are returning to do their second time. Then the other option is 10 weeks. So people who just finished their junior year of college could do 10 weeks, have that completed. So then they could commission as soon as they graduated. So those were kind of the paths that people could take. I know people that have taken both. People say I got the short end of the stick because I had to go twice. And that there was a whole part of that, right? Like I had to go back knowing that I was going to get my butt handed to me and have to go through that misery again. And some people could just knock it out one and done. But 10 weeks is also really hard on your body. And especially for women, a lot of people get injured or something like that happens because of the longevity of it. So that's kind of our process for OCS.
And that's specifically just for Marine Corps, is that right?
Yes, that's solely Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's different. So just a quick little explanation. In Canada, our Army, Navy, and Air Force, so we're all sort of under the Canadian Forces, and everyone does the same, what we call basic training. So if you're joining as an officer, then it's somewhere around 14 to 15 weeks, but everyone goes through like basic officer training. And then if you're an NCM, then everyone goes through the same. So regardless of whether you're Army, Air Force, or Navy, everyone does the same. And then they branch off into their element specific training after that. So that's why not sure. Yeah. So I know there's OCS and then there's TBS. So what is the difference between the two?
Yeah. So OCS is like the starting out. Mm-hmm. So you go to OCS to be able to commission as an officer. So I graduated OCS, but I wasn't an officer yet because I didn't have my college degree. Okay. So I had to wait until I graduated college. I had my degree and then I could commission into the Marine Corps and officially become an officer active duty that day. Mm-hmm. And then you go to TBS, which stands for the basic school. And kind of similar to what you were just talking about, all Marine officers go and then you get your job from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't get to choose in advance what your job is going to be?
No, you have to compete for it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, in Canada, it's basically when you apply, you can put your top 3 choices and then they'll offer you a choice based on one of those, but that's before you even go to basic training.
Yeah, no, you get stuck. You get sucked in. We have several people that didn't get what they wanted. I was one of those people. It worked out for me, but yeah, you don't get a pick. You get to put a preference. I mean, you list them out 1 to however many, but you could get your last choice. And there are people who got towards the bottom of their choices. So it's totally based off performance and slots allotted to certain jobs. It made TBS a lot more important in a different way. So OCS was about surviving, right? Mm-hmm. Like learning the ethos, learning all about the Marine Corps, trying to prepare yourself. And then TBS was, okay, we're all officers here. Who's going to be the best? But then from that, it's tricky because you'd spend 7 months at the basic school and then they list you into tier programs. So let's just say easy numbers. There's 300 Marine officers. It's tier 1, 2, and 3 always. And then jobs are allocated to those spots. So for instance, like a very common job that people want is intelligence, like different kinds of intelligence. So there might be three intel jobs, but only one to the first tier, one to the second tier, one to the third tier. So you can finish higher, you can finish 12th, and someone who finishes 201 would get that job over you. So it's interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's so neat, like you said, because OCS just being about surviving, right? But then it's like, no, you have to actually now work and show that you're going to be at the top. So what was your first choice originally?
Yeah, so I was between two. So intelligence was one that I really wanted. I studied Russian when I went to George Washington, not my major, but I took that on because I wanted to help the Marine Corps. And I thought, you know, Russia's always been somebody to keep our eyes on, and being able to speak the language would be super beneficial. Or I wanted to do Comstrat, so public affairs, that kind of thing. And then I ended up getting my eighth choice of logistics, which was super funny. I'm so blessed and happy that I got it looking back on it now, but I finished in the top 40 of my class of 270 and I got my eighth choice, but you know, God was looking out for me. I'm so glad I got logistics and it works out. I love my job. I look now at the jobs I thought I wanted and I'm like, wow, I'm really glad I didn't get that because it sounded really cool, but it wasn't for me.
You were mentioning before, you know, you thought doing the six weeks at a time might be better for injury wise and sort of recuperation. So with both of those courses, how did you find yourself mentally and physically? Do you feel like you're prepared for them?
I would say there was a huge culture shock the first 6 weeks. Like I said, I didn't have any military experience. I wasn't really able to go to a bunch of the events. They have what's called mini OCS. It's like a 2-day trying to like get you ready. I was playing softball. So I finished my softball season, we made it to our conference tournament. And 2 days later, I have to show up at OCS. And I show up with my hair down and I have no idea what's going on. And I just got pounced on, yelled at immediately. And it was a huge culture shock. So I'm like, what's going on? I didn't know the difference really that much in rank. I didn't know, you know, and it's scary. Like you're walking around, you're with girls and men that you've never met before. You're not sleeping. You don't have your phones. You have no idea what's going on in the outside world. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get to talk to your family. You're not getting letters until several weeks in. So it was a culture shock. Now, the second time I knew exactly what to expect. It was awesome because I knew that. I mean, I still got challenged significantly. Don't get me wrong, but I knew how to mentally prepare. And so I was able to do that for OCS. TBS was a different beast. My husband and I were together. We were married at the time. So he ends up being an infantry officer, but I had him with me and we went through the whole 7 weeks or 7 months together, which was such a blessing, like having him, you know, like the last time you don't really have an out, you make friends, but I had stability and I had friends that I went to OCS with. So it was more familiarized and you're an officer already. So you're automatically treated better. You're not getting yelled at, you're screamed at. It was more, you're being tested differently for your job. So it was kind of up to you. So definitely within the first month, you adjust quickly and it's a better learning environment because again, you're supposed to be learning to be an officer and be ready for your Marines compared to the OCS like survivability.
Right, right. Yeah. Cause I guess they've got to get everyone in and start, you know, with the basics of like being a Marine and how to dress and do all that and then get the leadership side of things. And then, so how do they decide where you get posted or I guess in the US they call it PCS station. Maybe or station? Yeah.
Yeah. Where you're stationed. Yeah. Yeah. So PCS is just permanent change of station where will you move? Yes. Yeah, so similarly, like I was talking about how you get ranked, you put in a preference for your job and then you put in a preference of where you want to live or like where you want to be stationed, what base, what coast you want to be on. I'll put it that way. So we have basically, we call them like three MEFs, but you have like West Coast, like California, Arizona, and then you have East Coast, which is Quantico, Lejeune, and there's even like South Carolina, Beaufort, and all that stuff. And then you have Pacific, which is Japan, Okinawa, all that places in Hawaii. So you kind of rank where you want to go and they take that into consideration. So like I said, I got my eighth choice in my job. I got my number one pick in location and duty. So I got to go to Camp Pendleton in Southern California. So that worked out well. So because I got that, my husband and I both were able to come, but you move every 2 to 3 years. So I'm most likely in another year going to be going to the East Coast, either in Quantico, Virginia, or to Lejeune in North Carolina. And so it's just kind of a rotation. You just always are moving and going.
And so how does that work? Do they try and keep service couples together for that?
Yes. And okay. They do a good job. Now, when I was talking about earlier about the jobs that I wanted, one of the other jobs I wanted was certain things with helicopters and like the air side of things. And so there's different bases for that. So for instance, like we have a big base here in Yuma, Arizona, which is like the West Coast, but it is more focused on air. And if I would have gotten that, I could have been stationed separately from my husband. So they would have put us both on West Coast, but we would have been separated. So me having a big logistics job, which is needed everywhere, and him as an infantry officer, which is literally everywhere, it allows us to get stationed easier. So we'll never not be stationed together, but just because we're stationed together doesn't mean we're together. So deployments and exercises and stuff, we actually find ourselves apart a lot more, but
right. Yeah. It's similar in Canada where it's, you know, like you said, you might be in the same location, but then that doesn't mean that, you know, your spouse might be deployed. I have neighbors that sort of flip-flop. One of them will be sailing and she'll get home and then he's out sailing. So it does get difficult in that sense.
Oh, and we've found ourselves in our first 2 years here in Southern California together, I think maybe 4 months out of the past 18.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Have you been deployed yet?
I have not. No. I'm in a non-deployable unit as a whole. So funny, I told you earlier that I wanted to be in the air community. So I actually am, but in a different way. So I'm a ground logistics officer, a part of the ACE. So on the air wing, where I'm supporting the ground movements for the air. So it's kind of funny. So there's not many, very many ground officers. And I'm one of two logistics officers for the Marine Air Group of thousands of Marines. And my unit as a whole, so I work at what's called MALS, Marine Aviation Logistics Squadron. There's about 800 Marines. And as a unit, we are non-deployable, but some of the other flying squadrons are. So we send detachments of like 50 Marines or so to go out on these deployments. So I don't see a deployment coming up in my future while I'm in California, but when I go somewhere else, that's definitely something that's doable. When I checked in, I was told that I wasn't going to deploy, which is what really triggered my bobsled career taking off more, because I had the ability knowing that I wasn't going to have to leave the country.
Moving on to that, how did you get involved in bobsled?
Super random. People are like, what? They're like, the Cool Runnings movie? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you ever practice in the bathtub.
No, that's not a thing. But the movie makes it look fun. So going back, when I played softball at George Washington University, one of the best now pilots in the United States is named Alana Myers Taylor, and she was an alumni of GW softball. So she played about 14 years before me. And when she won silver in 2018 in Pyeongchang, we invited her to come speak at George Washington and like kind of give her like a ceremony and congratulate her and all this stuff. And because I was captain at the time, I presented her the award. So I got some one-off time with her. And right then and there, I had butterflies in my stomach hearing her talk about it, because I'm like, wow, it's a combination of speed and power and just like strength. And it's like a combination of that. And I'm like, that is who I am as an athlete. You know, like I'm a powerful softball player, but I was super fast also, stealing base and that kind of stuff. And I was like, that is what I'd want to do. And I remember that night telling one of my friends, you know, in a different world, I would be a bobsled athlete because I have the military, like I'll never be able to do that. And so I didn't know it, but there was the seed that was planted in my mind right then and there. And after TBS was over, because OCS and TBS like takes a lot out of you, it's very specific training for it, I get here and I was told that I was non-deployable. I was told my husband's going to be deploying, and I just felt like I didn't peak in my athletic career yet. You know, I was 22, 23, and I'm like, wow, I have so much more to give than what I had. So I saw that they were having tryouts. It was called a combination combo, and they were just looking for people to see if they had what it takes. Very similar to like NFL combine, like those kind of testing. We did like a combine. So comprised of a couple events. So I got my husband, I was like, hey, let's go film me and see where I'm at. You know, like what does it hurt? Right. And so we did that. And I remember I reached out to Alana. Alana got me in contact with the head coach, who happens to be in the Army. And the next thing I know, I'm going to Park City, Utah for a month to train. And I did well enough that they kept asking me to stay. And I did so well that in January, I was able to compete in my first competition and I won 2 bronze medals. So it was unbelievable. And so I've just been really lucky that the Marine Corps has supported me in doing this, because I think they see value that I'm trying to help recruit females. I'm trying to show that the Marine Corps, you can do both if you work hard, you know? So I've always worked when I'm gone and I'm traveling. So I'll go and compete and I still have to work. So I'm still answering emails, on phone calls and all that stuff. So it's not like it's a free pass. I'm still having to do stuff. But as of now, I'm able to balance and do both and just trying to make a statement like that for so many women out there.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting to hear about bobsled because I mean, it's such a huge sport in the Winter Olympics, but it's not one of those sports that, you know, people grew up playing, right?
No.
So it's kind of interesting how they sort of pick from other athletes from other high level sports. And then that's how they doing that combine, they see who can perform those movements and those exercises the best. And then from there, sort of take them and mold them into bobsled athletes.
Yeah. And that's what we do in the US. No one grows up, like you said. And I think part of that is because of like the danger aspect in it, right? Mm-hmm. We're going down, we're experiencing G-forces, very similar to fighter pilots. And you're going upwards of 80, 90 miles per hour. And that's just not safe for kids, right? So a lot of the athletes that we get are 18 or most of the time out of college. And they really go for, like Cool Runnings movie, they'll go for track athletes. And then mm-hmm. sometimes like Alana and I are softball players. And we've had people that have played other sports as well. So I know Canada has a really good team. Germany has a really good team. Sometimes they get people that are already a little bit younger. For the US, it's a little bit harder for us because we have so many other sports that top athletes gravitate to. But then bobsled does their best to then recruit within those.
Actually, one of the top Canadian bobsledders is now competing for the US, Kaylee Humphreys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And she lives like 10 minutes from me. And we train
really?
At the same facility. So it's a small world.
Well, I have follow her on Instagram and I always see her videos of her training and she is just like a beast in the gym.
She is. She's a beast. I mean, seeing her and like me stand next to her, you have to witness it in person. Like she has worked so hard. She's so fit and strong. So it's just really cool that she's such a veteran and I'm such a new rookie. And yeah, I get to be at the same facility and live 10 minutes from her. It's really cool. It's a blessing.
How much does a bobsled weigh?
So yeah, they're very heavy. It's about 365 pounds.
Whoa.
So they're not light. And so that everyone talks about Cool Runnings and I always tell them that there's some discrepancies within the movie. And one of the big ones is at the end when they put the sled over their head and carried it across the finish line. That sled is so heavy. That is not happening. Like you cannot just like clean it and press it like that. So moving the sleds is half of the sport. And people hurt themselves, like their backs and everything by moving sleds because there's so much that has to go into it just to have that, you know, minute run down the track. So they're heavy.
Yeah. And then what does that feel like? So I suppose they don't just kind of throw you in a bobsled and send you down, or how does that work for your first time doing it?
They do. Yeah. So not from the top though, not from the top. So
Okay. Yeah,
there's like, we call them like lower starts. So you'll do like half of the track and you won't have a running start. So it takes a while to gain speed and momentum and you won't really get the height on a lot of these curves. So when I first started, I was in Park City, Utah, and there's 15 curves there. And from curve 6, they kind of just walk you off into it. And so you're really slow first. So for curve 6, 7, and 8, you're just like crawling, like trying to gain momentum on your way down. So you're only really driving 4 or 5 corners.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you master that, then they'll like keep moving you up to the top and up until you're sprinting off, like going full speed down. So and they kind of baby you into it, but honestly, it's hard sometimes because these tracks aren't meant for you to start halfway and to not mm-hmm. have momentum. So it almost makes it harder because sometimes you can't drive the way you're supposed to from a lower start. You have to do it from the top, but you're going from the top and you're crashing and you're just like, what's happening? And crashing is not fun and it hurts. So we're still working on ways to try to like help with that, but it's mm-hmm. kind of one of those things of you just got to get thrown into it. One, hopefully you like it. Two, hopefully you get down safely. And three, you can continue and move up from there.
Right. And so what would be the max speed that it goes?
So there's certain tracks that gain more speed than others. So I know the fastest track is actually in Canada. It's called Whistler. That's the fastest track. And there's been women who've gotten around 90 miles per hour on that track.
That sounds terrifying, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Whistler is known for that. And it is a hard track because of that. You have to make decisions so quickly and in a small air, you know, will tip you over.
So when you went down your first time, like your first full run at speed, were you terrified or were you like, this is awesome. This is exactly what I want to do.
It was awesome. I remember like I got down and I was like woohooing and like screaming. It was like, let's go, you know, like, here we go again. Now there's definitely times now where you get shaken up, especially at like the Lake Placid track and they call it like the baby rattler and it kind of gets you. So even a good run, like you're kind of just messed up from it. So there's definitely times when you get down, and you're like, okay, I need a minute.
Yeah.
Let me get myself together. But the first time I was like, this is exactly what I want. Like, I'm somewhat of an adrenaline junkie. Like, I've gone skydiving. Like, I'm in the military, like shooting, you know, like that kind of stuff. But I think it just incorporated everything I wanted to in a sport. You know, in softball, I'm 40 feet away and you're pitching a ball 70 miles per hour at me. And then, you know, in military, it's about making quick decisions, shoot, move, and communicate. And so I have that in a competing form in like the sport that like I'm driving and I'm in control. It's fascinating. It's awesome. Not for everybody, but it's super awesome.
And so bobsled, is it two people per bobsled?
So there are three types of bobsled races. So there's a mono, which is just one person, and that's only for women right now. Then there's two women and two man, and that's like the traditional two people. So we have both disciplines, men and women, in that one. And then four man, which is just for men to compete in.
How come they have the four man only for men?
Yeah, that's a hot topic right now. And a lot of times people are pushing it. So actually Kaylee and Alana, two pilots I've mentioned, have driven four man to try to push for that. I think the reasoning behind it is it's really hard to get four women from smaller nations and they're trying to be really inclusive. So they made mono bob this year to try to help these smaller nations saying, hey, you only need one person to be able to compete in this compared to having to find three brakemen to be able and maybe get multiple sleds. So I think that is their reasoning for now. A lot of us women are trying to push for it because the men, obviously, because of that, have a lot more athletes. They have a lot more opportunities, especially when we're talking about Olympics. So I think that is something that the next generation of females might push for, and you may see something like that here soon. But for this Olympics, women are mono and two man, and men are two man and four man.
Okay. And so are you the two woman? Is that going to be your goal?
So I do both. So I drive mono and two man. So I'm a pilot. So I'm in that front position. And then the back position are called brakemen because they pull the brakes on the sled at the end. Not until the end, which is funny. It's not like a car. You can't just like be touching them the whole time through. So I will not be in this upcoming Olympics. That's like Kaylee Humphreys and Alana. And then my two other teammates, Brittany Reinbold and Nicole Vo. You most likely will be seeing them. They have been in the sport way longer than I have. Kaylee and Alana are multiple time Olympic medalists, and Brittany and Nicole have been in the sport for over 10 years. This is just my second year. So my goal is 2026, which is in Italy, Milan, and 2030, wherever they decide to have that. And then this year, my big goal and what is upcoming is junior world championships. So if you're under the age of 26 in bobsled, you're considered a junior, and it's in Austria, Innsbruck, Austria. So I am booking my flights actually this week for that. And I'll be competing there on that stage, which is my Olympics. Year two to be competing in something like that is huge. So that's what I'm striving for and working for this season.
Yeah, that's amazing. What are the dates for that?
January 17th to the 23rd.
Awesome. And I mean, how many, I guess, competitions would you do throughout bobsled season?
Yeah. So there's two circuits, very similar, I would say, to baseball. I don't know how well Canadians know. I think you guys know baseball, but MLB, there's kind of, I always say there's like a major league and there's like AAA. They're both great. You can filter kind of back and forth depending on where you're at. So for us, so because we're in North America, we have what's called the North American Cup. They're comprised of eight races between three tracks. So Whistler in Canada with y'all, and then Park City, Utah, and Lake Placid, New York. That goes about 2 months and there's eight races. So you'll do, they'll drink three in Whistler, two in Park City, three in Lake Placid this year. Sometimes they change it up, how many is where, but that's like the North American Cup. And then in Europe, they do something very similar to what's called the Europa Cup. And it's like the same thing, but that's kind of the AAA league. So you can still get points. And that's kind of what the whole season you're trying to build is like build points for yourself as a driver. But then we have like the MLB level, which is the World Cup. And they literally, what it sounds like, go all over the world. Majority of the tracks are in Europe, so they're going to spend a lot more time in Europe, but they'll go Germany, Austria, Latvia, and, you know, then they might come over here and do one in the US, maybe one in Canada. They might go over and do one in Korea, you know, maybe one in Sochi. So they kind of split that up and they have a race every week in a different location. And so you get points based off of that. But where the trick comes in is if you place first in a race in the North American Cup or Europa Cup, you get the same amount of points if you get 13th in the World Cup. So there's kind of some strategy. Like for me, example, I will probably never make the top 13 right now in the World Cup. Like there are just way too many amazing athletes. But if I get first place on my home track here in the United States, I get the same points as those 13th place people. And then the 14th or 20th sled, I get more points than them. Even though they're on World Cup, they're competing against better people, arguably. But at any time, if you're qualified, you can go up to World Cup depending on qualifications and stuff like that. So that's kind of how the bobsled series works. But obviously COVID messed that up a little bit last year, so we didn't fully see that. And then this year, because of the Olympics, all World Cup will be done by January because the Olympics are in February.
Yeah, that's right. I keep forgetting that the summer ones were late. Yeah, it's such an interesting sport because it's one of those ones that I always love watching it at the Olympics, but I don't know much or really anything about it outside of the Olympics. So it's really neat to learn all about how it works and the recruiting process and the training process and everything like that.
Yeah. And like, that's like the big thing is I didn't know that much either. And once you learn a little bit more about a sport, you can appreciate it a little bit more. You know, obviously as any sports fan, you see a crash and that's like, oh, but you know, you don't really fully understand like when you crash, like why or like what that means. They're like, oh, well, they were only off by a second. That's not that much, but actually it is. Like we're talking about hundreds of a second in this sport. It's just really cool once you like understand it a little bit more and you watch it, it'll like completely change your perspective.
So as a bobsled competitor, is it better to be in terms of weight wise, a little heavier going down the track?
Yeah. So there's a maximum weight between your sled and your two brakemen, or if I'm in mono, the sled and myself with like my helmet and everything in my shoes and stuff on. It's kind of like an equation. You're trying to figure out how can I be as fast as possible while being as strong as possible while maintaining a weight? Because if I'm not at the max weight, or I'm not close to the max weight that's allowed, I'm not going to go as fast technically, because the more mass you have, the faster you're going to go down. If I'm 10 pounds, 15 pounds underweight, they would add steel lead plates into my sled, which therefore I'm pushing a heavier sled than maybe my opponent. But if I'm at the max weight, but I lost speed because I just put on pounds, then I'm going to be slower. So it's kind of one of those where it's a fine line. You have to find what works for you and your equation of like, how does speed, power, and velocity play into it? And every athlete looks different. Alana Myers-Taylor is massive. Her and Keely are some of the two biggest pilots. But then you have some pilots that are like 150 pounds. And there's like a 30 pound difference between the two. So you're still able to compete. It's just, are you able to push as fast at your weight? And how much weight do you have to add in your sled? And is that making a difference? And we're talking about hundreds of a second here too. So it's interesting. So I'm trying to work with my coaches because my weight is going to look different of where am I the fastest and strongest at? And that may not be the number I want. And I might have to accept putting two extra pounds into my sled. But when you have two women or two men, you can use your brakeman for that. So sometimes if you're a lighter pilot, you could have a heavier brakeman and vice versa.
Yeah, it sounds definitely like very, very calculated. And like you said, you're down to the hundredths of a second. And now do they give you, I suppose you'd be working with like a strength and conditioning coach. Do they give you a program to follow?
So we each actually majority of the time have our own coaches. Okay. So we are located all over the United States. I'm sure the Canadian athletes are the same. They're located all over Canada. They're huge countries. Mm-hmm. So majority of the time we only slide October to March. So the other half we're at our home. And so a lot of us have coaches at home so we can constantly be viewed. And the majority of the time when you're building that strength and conditioning and working is in the off season anyway, because when you're sliding, that's what you're doing every day. Mm-hmm. So we each have our different coaches. The USA bobsled, we have a weight coach and strength coach that we could go to that can write a program. But like I said, they're not with us necessarily the whole year. So that's kind of varies sometimes on what people want to utilize them for.
Mm-hmm. So do you have someone in your hometown that you go and do like one-on-one sessions with?
Yes, I do. Okay. So I do one-on-one sessions 3 days a week. And then he programs my workouts the other days of the week, just because I work full time. So I'm not able to go see him every day, like a lot of other people are. But yeah, he's here in Southern California. I'm really blessed because Southern California is where a lot of professional athletes go. And it's like a professional training facility. So my coach, his name's Roy Holmes, and he works with like NFL players, world-class tennis athletes, and all this stuff. So I'm really lucky and fortunate that I have somebody that I see every day. And then with that, I have a dietitian and nutritionist. And then I have like my physical therapy, sports med team, all in one place, all in the building. And so they all work together as I'm in there. And so it's really nice.
That's awesome. And what are the main focuses of your training sessions?
Yeah. So Roy's working to get me as fast as possible. So I, like I said, did not come from track. I came from mm-hmm. softball. A lot of these, my teammates came from track. So I never was properly taught how to run. I was just always fast. So we work a lot on sprint mechanics, and my mind has been blown on how much emphasis there is into sprinting. Like, I had no idea. And it's awesome to learn about, and it's made me a better athlete in person and appreciate track so much more. So we're working on that. And then the second half of our session, we're working on being explosive and powerlifting. So a lot of power cleans, some overhead movements, fast, explosive things to keep me snappy, but still movable. It's fun. I'm glad he has to program it, because I wouldn't know how else to do it.
Yeah. Cause I mean, a lot of it, I guess, is in the start, right? Like how explosive you can be pushing yes. that sled at the beginning is kind of a big part of it, right?
Yeah. And cause like we talked about, that sled's heavy mm-hmm. and you're starting in a static position and you got to get going, and I only have about 20 to 30 meters too. And that start is what puts me in a good spot for the whole rest of the race. So the start is extremely important. And so exactly, I need to be as fast as possible for a short amount of distance, but also have the strength that when I hit that sled, I can push into it instead of letting it push me back.
Wow. And then, so you said that you, when you're going away to training and things, you still have to work and do your job. How do you find that balance?
I still learn it every day by the grace of God. I'm able to complete it. It's tough, especially being in different time zones. So a lot of times when I go, like I talk about, I go to Utah or New York, primarily New York, that's 3-hour time difference. So I'm up early getting my training in and staying up a little bit late at night to be on work calls and ensuring things get done. I'm not able to move my sliding schedule around too much. So when practice is, it's practice. And I kind of let my work know, hey, from these hours, I won't be available. When I'm not, you know, I don't sit down and watch TV or have relaxing time. I'm right in there. I'm working. I'm making sure the Marine Corps and my Marines specifically are taken care of and operations are running as normal. And when I have meetings, I'm making sure I can call in and still be a part of it. And COVID has actually helped me because it's made the world go a little bit more remote. So I'm still able to get things done.
The one thing, you know, if there's one thing that people probably realize after COVID is that a lot of meeting and work can be done remotely, you know, more than people thought originally.
Absolutely. And even for the military, which is like pretty interesting. But the staff, because I'm the S4 officer, I run logistics. I'm not really day-to-day working on an airplane or helicopter like some of my other people within my squadron are. You know, I'm someone who's more overseeing, coordinating, and a lot of that's not on the phone and computer anyway.
And then, so do they give you time off for going to competitions, or do you have to take vacation days for that?
So yeah, I don't have to take my own personal vacation days. So we call it leave. Like I don't take my personal leave, but I have what's called PTAD, which is permissive temporary active duty.
Okay.
And the Marine Corps has an order that's stating if you are competing in an Olympic level event, then you're able to take this. Not very many people do, because I'm one of very few Marines that are pursuing something like this. But at the end of the day, it's up to my local command. So I have a CO and an XO. My XO is Major DePriest, and my CO is Lieutenant Colonel Bemis. And I have to get both of their permissions to even go. So at any point, they could be like, hey, Riley, or Lieutenant Compton, no, you're not going. We can't do this. So I try to work with them ahead of time, get all my work done early, like that the work I need to be there, and just communicate with them and stay in good graces with them and do my job. So I don't give them a reason to hopefully ever say no.
Yeah, that's good. We have similar in Canada. I mean, there's all sorts of different special leave that people can take. I'm not too sure about non-military sports, but definitely people get time off for competing, you know, on the military teams.
Yeah.
I think it's so neat too, because like once you get to that more like Olympic level, it would be such a, almost like an advertisement for the Marine Corps. You know what I mean? Like people can see that and be like, oh, I can join the Marine Corps and be this high level athlete. And maybe that's something that they didn't realize they could do before.
And that's my goal, is I'm trying to show the Marine Corps, you know, we spend X amount of money on billboards and recruiting, and I'm a walking advertisement. I believe in the Marine Corps. I chose the Marine Corps. I stuck after it. And that's something that I wanted to do. And I want to be able to give back. And so that's why I tell them, like, hey, me doing these opportunities, I can work with these recruiting stations. I can go and speak at events. I can be your, like I said, walking billboard to like help recruit people that never maybe thought it was possible. Or back to what we talked about in the very beginning of this podcast is like, I never saw women in that role. People knowing that there's possibilities. And truly, like, if you work hard, good things happen. And also don't let anyone tell you no. It's such a big one because immediately what I thought back in 2018, when I saw the silver medal from Alana, was like, wow, I would never be able to do that. But I was telling myself no before I even gave myself a chance. But I had to work hard. I had to prove that I could balance it. You know, I had to do good at my job and perform and be a good wife and all the above to be able to be in that position. And it's a grind. I mean, there's sacrifices, don't get me wrong, but it's possible. And that's just what I'm trying to show people. So I'm trying to get my story out there. I'm trying to share it with the Marine Corps. I've worked with several recruiting stations that are working to recruit Marines. And I've done a lot of pieces with the Marine Corps news, basically, and like getting that out. And I've had an amazing amount of support because this hasn't really been done before.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I always find it so much cooler. Like you said, you know, you could see a billboard or there's an actual person with their story. And even, you know, I don't know if you've heard of this guy on YouTube, the Iron Wolf, and he just does all these burpee workouts and he's got this huge following, but he's in the Marine Corps, but it's like free advertising for them, right?
Exactly. And I've had so many people reach out to me on social media and they're like, hey, ma'am, you know, I'm not really anybody, but I'm interested in the Marine Corps. Can you tell me about it? Or they have questions. And I'm like, yes. And this is what I want. Like, I want to engage with you. Like, I want to share my experience and help you out to make sure that we always have the best of the best in the Marine Corps or in the military period. And if that's something that you want, not to feel like you don't have the resources or people to know to talk to. Yeah, it's been awesome. I love it. And that's such a beautiful thing about social media that wasn't in the past, is it can get out there and it can get out to the whole world and quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And then that sort of like leads nicely into my next question, which is, what advice would you give to women thinking about joining the military?
The advice number one I would give is, you absolutely have a place here and don't let anyone tell you that you don't. The Marine Corps has about 5 to 8% of officers are females. That's it. 5 to 8%. And I want to do everything I can to change that, because there are amazing women out there that have a place and a seat at the table and bring a whole different perspective on leadership. I'm the first female several of my Marines have ever worked for as a leader. And the feedback I've gotten is incredible. I don't yell. I don't curse. That's just not how I operate. Part of that's because I'm a female. Part of it's my religious belief. Part of it's just who I am, which is very different than what they've ever had. But every single one of my Marines has been able to come in and talk about personal issues and things that they've been struggling with that they've never been able to tell any of their other leaders. I'm more empathetic. I'm more understanding. You know, they all have spouses. They have pregnancies. They have things come up. I get that. And I'm able to give them a different perspective. And because I don't yell at them, because I challenge them in a different way, they respond so much better to that leadership style. So, you know, there's just this persona that the military is, you get yelled at and you're miserable and you're nobody. And that's not necessarily the case. And that's not our case in this day and age. We have been in peacetime. So we're garrison Marines that have to figure out a different way to continue to be motivated and stay ready. And I feel like I've been able to give that perspective. But so many times people see the Marine Corps as male dominated and unreachable. And so I just want to let any female know, like, yes, it has the hardest physical fitness tests. Yes, there's the fewest amount. Yes, we have the least amount of money, but you have a seat at the table and you can help impact that and make a difference. And I'm trying to pay that way. So it's easier for other women to do it as well.
It's almost like the yelling, and people did it back in the day. And then there were the people who were sort of trained under those people. And oh, well, that's what happened when I went through training. So they continue to do that. But, you know, it definitely has a very specific time and a place when it should be done. But I mean, the day to day, you know, I think I'm definitely seeing changes within the Canadian military of people sort of not just doing that for the sake of it, and leaders trying to be more empathetic and understanding when they need to be. So I think things are moving in the right direction with regards to that, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's on us as leaders to continue to instill that behavior. And no, I mean, there's a time and place for yelling. If you mess up, you know, we were yelled at. There's a part of it that gives you a tough skin. Like, life's not easy. But like you said, day to day, is that really necessarily how we have to treat people? No, there's ways to get the job done and the task done efficiently without making people feel bad about themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And so then what are your future goals for your career? And then I guess you already said your Olympic goals for the bobsled.
Yeah. So for bobsled, I already talked about that, but 2026 and on, and continue to represent the Marine Corps. My goals in the Marine Corps, I want to be in for as long as possible. I want to be in for 10 plus years. My husband wants to make a career and do 20. So I might get roped into that. So there's that. I think my biggest goal though, overall, is I just want to inspire other people to follow their dreams and openly be true to who I am throughout the whole process. You know, I'm very passionate about my faith and where I'm at with the Lord. And while I'm here, I'm very passionate about the Marine Corps, and I'm passionate about being able to be a wife and still being able to do it all. So that's what I just want to get out to people. And I want them to know that the women have a seat at every table and specifically military and specifically professional sport, because that's somewhere where we're seeing it lack. So
awesome. Yeah. Such a perfect guest for this podcast. Like when you sent me that message, I was like, yes, this is so perfect. I think that I'd come across your page before, but I couldn't remember what your name was. And then I couldn't find it again. And then you messaged me. So that was so perfect.
I look for other women that are doing very similar things to me. And I'm like, hey, we're doing the same thing. Let's team up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another thing is like, don't feel like you have to do anything yourself. Like there's other people out here and we're stronger, unified, and being like, hey, let's put two brains at this and let's keep pushing the same message, because you're doing it from Canada and I'm trying to do it here at the United States. So we're on the same team.
Yeah. And I've wanted to get so many more international women on the podcast as well, because I didn't want this ever to be just Canadian. I was like, I want to speak to women from the States or from Europe, which I haven't really done yet, but just everyone, right? And it's so much better working together rather than women who try and compete against each other. So where can people find you on social media?
Yeah. So I'm very active on Instagram at ryri.compton, C-O-M-P-T-O-N. Ry is just a nickname and Compton is very common. So they didn't have Riley Compton. So you could find me on Instagram. Other than that, I kind of try to stay off of other social media sites solely so I just have one and done, so I don't get distracted with everything else that I have to do. But yeah, you can follow me on my Instagram page, shoot me a DM message, anything. And then I also do have a GoFundMe that I'm trying to work right now to help fund my season. The United States does not give money to their Olympic sports like some other countries. So a lot of us are self-funded. And if you're not in that top one or two sleds, you know, you're not really given a whole lot. You're given some and work part of the team, and grateful for that. So those are the two things I've been working on right now, my Instagram and my GoFundMe. And stay tuned. Hopefully Junior Worlds is going to be on YouTube. It's going to be televised, so you guys can see that. And then I'm going to be on a Netflix documentary here soon for bobsled.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
In January. So that will drop in January. So feel free to catch me on that as well.
Is there a link to the GoFundMe in your Instagram?
There is.
Okay,
yes.
Perfect. I'll watch the worlds on YouTube. And then I'm so interested now, like, and I live fairly close to Whistler. So I'm like, oh, I wonder if there's going to be anything there. I'll go watch it live.
There is. There's a race November 4th through the 13th.
I'll have to go take a look, because I feel like it would be just crazy to see the speed and the power in real life.
Oh, you have to. It's unlike anything. It literally whizzes by.
Yeah.
You blink and it's by, but you can hear the sound and the speed and it's super cool.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. This has been such a great chat. You're the perfect sort of person that I wanted to have on this podcast. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to help support this podcast, please subscribe and leave a rating and review on your Apple Podcast app.